Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, I'm Zoe Ball, and over there, opposite me, sits a very handsome man in a rather nice tie, shirt and jacket. You're looking very smart, James King.
No trousers. Nice shirt, tie and jacket.
And in a downward dog position for the entire show. As you may have gathered, Simon and Mark are not here. I'd like to tell you where they really are, but I'm not allowed, apparently. I'm really sad that during the show, I broke a rule.
It's
terrible. I broke one of Winter Entertainment's code of conduct. In fact, I can't even say Wittertainment. There we go. That's better. How are you anyway, James King?
Yeah, I'm very good. Yeah, it's good to work with you again.
I
remembered
it's
another
been a
time.
While.
Another, because we talked on the show about the first time we met, but I've also remembered that at the, this is going to sound like name dropping, but it's not, at the Cannes premiere of Moulin Rouge.
Yes, of course.
And your man, I seem to remember, wasn't allowed in because he didn't have a tie.
He didn't have a bow tie.
Yeah.
And he had some kind of, he doesn't ever really have tantrums, but he did have a little moment as we ran up and down the high street. Of Cannes.
Le Croisette.
Obviously, thank you.
Yeah.
Neither was speaking any French. I think I just had a baby, was quite stressed and sweaty, begging people to lend us 10 euros, I think it was, in the, 10 francs, I think it was still francs, so that Norman could buy a bow tie off a security guard to get into his
own. And then you met me with a microphone wanting to talk about it, which must have been made
and
even worse.
We were quite stressed out. And Norman was like, they won't be able to start the film. I was thinking, I think they probably will start, you know, the Coppolas are here. I think it's probably going to start without us. But an amazing night. And that was a brilliant, brilliant story because Nicole Kidman had just recently spat with Tom Cruise, hadn't she? So the world's press really were watching
her.
Great night. And she even got in the DJ booth and put Norman's sweaty headphones on her head. I mean, they were dripping. Bless her. I thought I saw another side to Nicole Kidman that night. And I thought, wow, you really are an amazing actress. It was the only time I ever went. Never been invited back, funnily enough.
It's a good night, though.
It was a great night. So here is the show. Afternoon all, a tad later than planned. Mr. Mayo and the good doctor have gone to a 3D movie convention with their mate Danny Dyer this afternoon. So they've asked Sea Captain Skipper James King to join me, First Mate Zoe Ball, to man the helm of the HMS Movie Review Show this afternoon. We are licensed mariners, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully you're in safe hands. Afternoon, Captain King, how are you?
I like Captain, that's good. I would love to go to a 3D convention with Danny Dyer and Mark and Simon. That would be amazing.
I think there might be fisticuffs before the afternoon is out. Now, there's so much I'd like to talk to you about. We had a good half an hour about when we last hung out, because it's quite a while ago, isn't it?
Yeah, it was film related.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Was it on the west coast of America?
I wish.
No.
It was at Pinewood Studios.
What were we doing at Pinewood Studios?
You were in a movie, Zoe.
With Bill Nighy.
You were.
I had a walk-on part. I couldn't do that either. I was terrible.
And I came down to the set because we were both at Radio 1. And I was recording interviews with you and some other people down there. And that's where we first met.
Oh.
Did you have a line in it or not?
I did have a line and I never said it the same more than three times. It was awful.
I'm sure Daniel Day-Lewis does the same thing.
Exactly. You know, it takes time, these things. Well, we've got much to get through this afternoon. James is going to be talking to Gemma Arterton about her role in Song for Marion
yes.
a bit later on.
It didn't take a huge amount of persuading to get me to do that interview. She's very lovely, very interesting talks, like you said, about Song for Marion, also about Byzantium, which is a new vampire movie she's got coming out, Hansel and Gretel, lots of stuff.
Right. OK, so that's coming up. Also, we'll talk to director Dylan Moen Gray. He'll be live in the studio to talk about his fantastic documentary, Fire in the Blood. We'll also have reviews of Cloud Atlas, Mama, Laura, Terence Malick's To the Wonder, and hopefully we get to it, Breath of the Gods, which is all about yoga. Plus, we look ahead to the Oscars this weekend and we'll have some of your correspondence and our TV movie of the week. We've lost half an hour to Pistorius, so we will get on with the top 10. James, how's it looking this week?
At 10, it's Flight, which is certainly a lot of movie for your money. There's a lot going on in this because you've got action in there, a spectacular kind of plane crash scene very early on in the film. You've got emotional drama in there. You've got comedy in there. So although ultimately it's a serious movie about redemption, it's also a pretty bonkers mix of everything plus the kitchen sink. I mean, Bob Zemeckis, who's the director, really throws everything in there. But then at the heart of it, of course, you've got Denzel Washington, kind of like the conductor and keeping everybody in time and keeping everybody together. And it works. You think, how does this work? I don't know, but somehow it does work. Lots going on, but still really entertaining.
Okay, I've not seen it. I fancy seeing it now. At number 9, Lincoln. I must admit, it took me a few attempts to get behind the language of the American politics. But then I watched an interview with Spielberg and he explained this particular story. And then I went back the second time. And I got it. What did you make of Lincoln?
Well, I think we can all agree that Daniel Day-Lewis will probably win an Oscar at the weekend, Sunday night. I mean, he's certainly the favourite. And it's an, I mean, it's an immaculate performance from him. I mean, he might be one of those guys, and we all kind of laugh about it a bit, who goes very deep into his role and says, you know, you've got to call me Abe. And, I'm only going to speak in an American accent for the next 6 months and all this kind of stuff. But ultimately, if that sort of method acting is producing these kind of performances, I'm not going to complain, because he is a joy to watch. And it's a much more intimate, really, and a poignant performance than I expected it to be. I went into Lincoln thinking it was going to be a big, huge Spielberg war epic, and actually it's quite a personal, small movie, and I think that actually is its real charm. Look, am I going to go and watch it over the years as much as I've watched Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark?
E.T. Probably
not,
okay,
to be honest, but yeah, it's still a very impressive movie.
Okay, and Zazie on YouTube says, I agree with Mark last week about Daniel Day-Lewis. He's just so good in this role in Lincoln. Probably the best and most amazing performance since Brando in The Godfather. That is a strong comment.
Yeah.
And he's almost in a completely separate zone in this film.
I mean, he is, actually. Yeah, I mean, he seems so far ahead. And I think this is why he's the favourite to win the Academy Award, because although the other people are very good in that category, they're just nowhere near as good as he is.
He was very charming at the BAFTAs. I was quite nervous. And I love the fact that he was quite jovial about everyone's opinion of him as well. And he can take the mickey out of himself.
I think there is an opinion that he is very, very serious. And I'm not saying he wasn't like that in the past, but I think certainly he's lightened up quite a lot recently.
Wonderful. Looking forward to Sunday. We'll talk hopefully later on about the Oscars. OK, at number 8, Sammy's Great Adventure. Yeah. Tell me about, I haven't had the chance to see this, about two leatherback turtles. It's a cartoon.
Yeah. Aimed at 5-year-olds.
Animation.
I actually didn't go to the press screening because I think fairly reasonably no one would ever ask me what I thought about it. And then I got booked to do this. So I went to see it this morning.
Yeah.
I went to the box office, and I have a press pass for this cinema chain. Yeah. So I gave it over and said, one for Sammy's Great Adventure. And the bloke looked at me and he didn't quite know what to do. And he got on his walkie-talkie and said, message for the manager, I've got someone here who wants to see Sammy's Great Adventure from the press. Is that all right? Now, weirdly, what he said into his walkie-talkie kind of got beamed out via a PA system. So everyone in the cinema could hear this, and sort of everyone lining up for their tickets turned to look at me. And the manager goes, OK, who is it? What's his name? So back on the walkie-talkie, and he says, looks at my card and he sees my name. It's James King. James King wants to see Sammy's Great Adventure. Again, everyone look at me, very embarrassed.
You never
get the ticket, go into the cinema, you know, full of mothers with their toddlers, all stare at me as I walk in. What is this guy doing? But, you know, lights go down, watch the film. It's quite cute. And I think the main thing is, actually, it was useful to go and see it with that audience, who are the primary audience, is that they were quiet, which isn't easy.
Yeah, little
and they,
kids.
And they seemed gripped by the story and entertained and laughed at the right moments. So in that respect, it's a success.
Oh, fantastic. And who's this? Bryony Charlotte Tanner on Facebook would agree. Says, Sammy has a wicked soundtrack. Feels maybe a little wrong at times, but overall, very cute film for children. So it's not a cheap Nemo, is what, when
well,
I sort
I
of
mean,
saw...
Yeah, I mean, it is.
Cheap Nemo,
yeah,
but entertaining all the same.
And it has Rock Lobster by the B-52s on the soundtrack.
Perfect.
So.
It's been waiting. That film was made for that alone. At number 7, Django Unchained. Loved its bold and brash. Oh, it's just beautiful. Such a great film. So refreshing and an incredible cast. What did you make of that?
No, I agree. I mean, I think it could do with some editing. I think that Tarantino sometimes just sort of goes into, oh, I'll just do a really long shootout scene here, when actually I would prefer to see him, to hear more of his lines, because he's a great scriptwriter and great dialogue. And I think we could have had a bit more characterization instead of just a really, really, really long shootout at the end. But having said that, you know, indulgence is sort of par for the course with Tarantino. That's part of the whole experience of watching his movies. It is about all the ballsiness and the fireworks and the power to shock you, and all of that is in there. And like you said, some lovely performances. I think the one who's getting overlooked is Samuel L. Jackson, who has, you know, he sleepwalks through most of his films, let's be honest. He has done the same thing for about the last 20 years in Hollywood. So to see him play a character in this who is so different, and to see him really be a character actor, I think is actually a joy. And I would preferred, you know, I would have preferred to see perhaps him get an Oscar nomination over Christoph Waltz, who is fab, but is sort of doing what he's done before.
Do you think Christoph Waltz will win the award on Sunday?
Well, I mean, he won at the BAFTAs, which was a surprise. Tommy Lee Jones
was really emotional,
yeah,
as well.
I'm sure he was surprised too. Tommy Lee Jones has been the front runner for a long time, and now all of a sudden, just with a, you know, a few weeks to go, as it was when the BAFTAs happened, to the Oscars, then it, you know, all of a sudden Christoph gets it. So it's quite open now.
I know, exciting. Right, at number six, I Give It a Year. Over to you first.
I mean, there's a lot of very good comedy actors in this. I think Steve Merchant's stuff is brilliant, and it opens with his best man speech, which is very, very funny. And, you know, even people like Minnie Driver, Rafe Spall, they're good comedy actors.
Yeah.
So I think that the many shortcomings that the film has are made up for by the fact that these people are enjoyable to watch, mm-hmm. and just, you know, cute to watch on screen. That's a big thing. I mean, that may sound like a throwaway comment, but that's not easy to achieve, and they have that. I think the whole idea that it's sort of this groundbreaking romantic comedy because it starts with the wedding, whereas, of course, a lot of rom-coms end with the wedding. I don't think they really do enough with that. Actually, once it gets going, it's a very traditional romantic comedy. It has those kind of characters that only appear in Richard Curtis movies, who don't really exist in real life, just without a lot of the charm and the class that Richard Curtis has. So it's sort of familiar, but without the best familiarities, you know. So it's a mix.
I think the people
are lovable and quite nice, but I mean, it really could have been a bit classier.
My thing with it is, and I won't have time to have my rom-com rant, sort of radish rom-com rants. I've already heard it.
Yeah.
But my thing is, when you watch a romantic comedy, and if you go all the way back to, you know, It Happened One Night, or When Harry Met Sally, or, you know, Annie Hall, the idea is that you want them from the beginning to get together. You want to fall in love with both man and woman, or if it's, have we had many man-man romantic comedies? Maybe that needs to happen. And you want them to get together by hook or by crook, you know. And the problem with this, where I struggled, is I Give It a Year. If you're not madly in love in the first year of your marriage, that's supposed to be the best year, you're obviously not going to stay together. So there is, they're not going on very well. That's the end of the story. And then you bring two other characters who they might be in love with or they might not be, who neither of whom are massively likable. So you don't really want them to be with those two people either. So you end up really confused of, like, who do I want to be with whom? And then, obviously, I don't want to give anything away. But yeah, that's why, for me, it's more of a comedy with lots of funny bits.
Yeah.
But the romantic bits of it, I didn't get. And also, I think I love Rafe Spall. And I was sort of a bit, like, irritated slightly by her. I was thinking, but he's great. Why aren't you in love with him? And then I did have a good rant. I mean, certainly
the emotional side of it, I think, is the weak side.
Yeah.
And it is great to try and reinvent the rom-com and to do something different. But although that's the premise of this and the setup of this, I'm not sure whether it entirely fulfills that brief.
I know. Oh, Olivia Colman's shouty rant on the telephone, very funny.
Always
threesome, quite a funny scene as well.
Yeah.
Anna Faris, strange wig, what she done to her lip. Stop. Right, anyway.
And it's Anna.
You are?
It's Anna.
Oh, really?
She only responds to Anna.
Anna.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, she can forget it. Okay, what else have we got? So we're in the top 10 and we're at number 5 with Beautiful Creatures.
Which is great. I mean, I'm really disappointed this hasn't performed as well, actually. It's Twilight with chuckles.
Okay.
I mean, it's got the Twilight hallmarks, the school outsider falling in love with a mysterious otherworldly type. It's a witch in this case rather than a vampire. It's based on a series of teen novels. It's got the mood, it's got the atmosphere, very familiar Twilight kind of stuff. But crucially, this one has laughs. And how many times have you
and
sat
laughs as in intentional laughs, not as in this
yeah,
plot
genuine.
Is so
kind of,
thin.
It's got a sort of a slight cynicism to it, tongue in cheek, wit. And how many times have you sat through a Twilight movie thinking, if only they could just lighten up a little bit? Well, this does it. I mean, this is that movie. And great performances as well. I mean, Alden Ehrenreich is the lead guy, who's a really good young actor. But then you've got legends in it. Emma Thompson, Jeremy Irons. Fantastic. Having a great time. I think it's a really fun movie, but hasn't done that well.
Zoe Ball and James King with Movie Review for you this afternoon. We were talking about Beautiful Creatures, which James really loved. Elizabeth Nichols on Facebook says, went to see Beautiful Creatures on Tuesday, loved it, mainly because the two leads had way more chemistry than any on-screen couple I've seen for a while. It was a joy to watch them. Emma Thompson going full-on crazy was an unexpected surprise too.
I totally agree. And I mean, there's another teen film out at the moment, a teen sci-fi called Warm Bodies, which, again, is out of the top 10 after a week or so and really should have done better, because I genuinely think, like Beautiful Creatures, it's giving us something new, a new twist, But it just doesn't seem like the right time of the year for people to be actually going to see them.
OK. On the other hand, Richard Anstey on Facebook has been in touch, quite cross. Beautiful Creatures was pretty bad, had a couple of good gags, liked the misspelling of the film names at the local cinema. But apart from that, it was terrible. I counted at least 20 things different or missing from the book. Here lies the problem, perhaps. I gave up in despair. Not only did they completely miss the point of the book, they totally destroyed any chance of making any of the other four books in the series. There we go. Let that be a lesson. Never go and see a film or a book that you've liked. It will only disappoint you. We had this conversation, James and I, earlier on about books and films. Catch 22, I remember, was quite a good film, but I read the book a long time ago. Also, Papillon. I'm really going back and showing my age here.
Yeah.
But many books that you've seen, the film, and it's been good.
I mean, Life of Pi is good. I wouldn't necessarily say it was up there with my enjoyment of reading the book, but then your enjoyment of reading the book lasts a fortnight, a month, however long it takes you to read the book, and over a couple of hours, it can never quite be the same, can it? Silver Linings Playbook, I actually haven't read the book, but it's a very good movie, and I would be surprised if people who liked the book didn't like the film. It might not be exactly how they imagined it, but it's a very classy bit of filmmaking.
We will continue this conversation later on in the pub. Right, at number four in the top 10, Les Miserables. Did you like, James?
I did, yeah. And a lot of people do. 36 million quid this has done at the box office.
It's extraordinary.
Serious business, which is proving that people are going to see it again, seeing it more than once. But also, I think the people who didn't think they would enjoy it, such as myself, go to see it, love it, tell their friends and spread the word. I mean, this is every film distributor's dream. This is what they want to happen. And it's the power of it. I mean, I think that's the key thing. I don't personally like the fact that they just sing everything. I find I stole a loaf of bread. You know, just say it. Just say it. I don't understand that. However, you cannot deny that there is power in this. There is raw emotion in this. Some of the big set pieces are really spectacular. The performances are spectacular. And the quality is there. And I think it's just an example of just great filmmaking winning you over, whether you go into it thinking you're going to like it or not. Ultimately, if something is done really well and really strongly and powerfully, then it will work.
I know I was a bit concerned at the beginning when they start off with everything is going to be sung. I was a little cross. But then once you get into it, amazing. But I have to say, I didn't cry until, I know people sobbed through 2 hours of it. I actually cried when, is it Eponine, played by Sam Barker, when she sang in the rain?
I think
because he ran off with bug-eyed, what's-her-face, Cassette. It's like she was the, what's he not doing with her? And that's when I started.
Yeah.
And then when Eddie Redmayne sang Empty Chairs at Empty Tables, which I won't try and sing for you now, at that point I really, really did, I lost it a little bit. But this in from Rob Horton, he says, there is no doubt it's beautifully shot and that Anne Hathaway's performance is every bit as good as everyone has said it is. It, for me, has two major problems, however. It's too long. The bit after the barricade seemed interminable. Surely, when you go to see it at the theatre, the audience is given an intermission. Correct. Secondly, and far more seriously, it's not a musical. When the dialogue is sung, rather than the cast breaking into song occasionally, that, to my mind, is opera. There we go.
Well, Rob, I mean, it's certainly melodramatic and operatic, definitely. I mean, it's over the top. That's the style of these kind of things. But yeah, interesting, you mentioned Samantha Barks. I mean, I think she's sort of been a little bit overlooked, certainly in the awards. But, you know, I mean, wasn't she third in the Nancy programme?
In the Nancy. Nancy.
Yeah.
I know.
And now she's in this, and I think she steals the show. I mean, I think it's absolutely amazing performance.
I thought she was fantastic. At number three in the top 10, This Is 40. I have to confess, I haven't seen it. I have a bit of a problem with Judd Apatow films in that they are always at least an hour and a half too long.
Or 40 minutes too long. This Is 40 minutes too long, as I think Mark used last week. Again, it's too long. I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that. And I think the difference with this one over things like Knocked Up is that also there's a slight sort of whininess to it, I think, this time, because it is people, a couple, complaining about their life. And actually, when you look at their life, for us, we think, this is an amazing life. They're meant to be skint. They're meant to be hard up. They live in a fantastic house, have everything you could dream of. It doesn't quite ring true. But, you know, on the flip side, the one thing that Judd Apatow can do, he might not be able to edit his films very well, but he can sort of bring up universal problems that we can all go, yeah, I recognise that. That's happened to me. I understand what he's saying there, whether it is, I don't know, you know, the one night stand of Knocked Up or being a geeky teenager in Superbad, all those
these
kind
are
of things.
Personal things that have happened to you along the way.
Yeah,
James,
all in my autobiography. You know, and I think he can, and I think there are moments in This Is 40 where you do go, I recognise that. That's kind of a bit like my life, and I understand why you're saying that, and I understand why that's funny, and that's really his strength. But it is still too long.
OK. Jan has had a little bit of a rant. She says in the papers today there was an interview with Leslie Mann in which she inexplicably burst into tears. I think if I was married to Judd Apatow, I'd do that on a regular basis. In case we missed the misogyny and Knocked Up, he makes it crystal clear this time on This Is 40 when two male characters go into a cafe to discuss how they wish their wives would die. This is not cute observational humour. It is not even conversation from real life. This is dark. She then goes on to say an awful lot about how it shows neurotic women making contented men suffer. Pete's having a nice life, hanging out with his friends. Meanwhile, Debbie, turning 40, aims her meltdown in his direction, all because she's not happy with how she looks and it's all about sex. Anyway, she has quite a good rant about it, and I think she raises some very good points.
Absolutely.
And Jen, I would read your email in full if we weren't up against it. But I will, maybe we could discuss it further in the podcast.
But Leslie Mann being married to Judd Apatow obviously doesn't seem to mind
she
that very much.
She doesn't mind that at all.
No.
At number two, Wreck-It Ralph.
Which works for me, I think, because it borrows from the best. I mean, it borrows heavily from Shrek, that kind of ogre-like character that everyone thinks is really horrible and they're scared of, but actually he's quite sweet-natured and becomes a hero. It borrows a lot from Toy Story because this is about video games and what happens to them when everyone leaves the arcade, a bit like, you know, when everyone leaves the nursery in Toy Story. So although it's very high-tech and futuristic and 3D and CGI, wow, 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 actually it's very traditional when it comes down to it, and made up of very recognisable elements. Story goes off a little bit about three quarters of the way through, but John C. Reilly, Sarah Silverman, great voice talent.
Great cast there. My son saw it, he's 12, and he said he laughed out loud at least five times that he would see it again. He said he'd give it 8 gold medals out of 10. Apparently that's sort of part of the plot.
It is.
Luke from Stafford said, as a gamer, I often feel that I am part of a community that's been much aligned by the film industry. I'm glad to say that Wreck-It Ralph may have helped to mend some of the damage done by Resident Evil and Doom. And he's quite excited at the news that the Witter Entertainment favourite Duncan Jones will be directing an upcoming Warcraft movie. So that's very exciting news for Luke. And also Duncan, who took his son George
not
3
Duncan
to
Jones.
See it. Not the Duncan Jones,
right.
No. Is he son of David?
He certainly is.
Of Bowie? Do you say Bowie or Bowie? Yes. Moon, brilliant.
Yes.
Duncan took his son George, not been to the cinema together before, and they loved it. And apparently George was very well behaved during the whole thing. A very nice bonding experience. Okay, which means at number one in the top 10, A Good Day to Die Hard.
I think what's most interesting about this is that you watch the film and Bruce Willis looks bored, to be honest. He looks like he doesn't really want to be there. And then you watch him promote the film, as he has been doing for the last few weeks, famously on The One Show.
On The One Show, of course.
Again, looks bored, slates the title, says, who came up with this title? It's rubbish. And you just think, Bruce, what? You know, why did you do it?
Why did you do
what,
it?
You
in
don't
the first
look
place.
Like your heart is really in it.
Yeah.
But I know that that's often the answer. But then you have to ask yourself, how much money does Bruce Willis actually need? I mean,
yeah,
really, surely
point.
He must have quite a lot of money, I would have thought. But my problem with it is that it doesn't live up to the majesty, certainly of a couple of the other diehards. You know, they were groundbreaking films. That first one was a groundbreaking thing, did something very different. John McClane was a legendary, iconic action hero because of the way he did things, because of his one-liners, because of his charm. And all of those things seem to have gone from this movie. It's not a terrible action movie. It's just a very generic action movie. And diehard films really shouldn't be generic. They should stand out from the crowd. That's the whole reason why they were so successful.
That's in a Partisan on YouTube channel said that it can't be said often enough. The thing about the original Die Hard was that John McClane, again agreeing with you, was not a stereotypical pumped up 80s action hero, but a regular Joe who used mostly his wits rather than his brawns to fight the bad guys. 25 years later, the character has become just the same old tired macho cliche it originally was played up against. It's all become a bit sad. I went to see it, really didn't want to go, but because of doing the show, I thought, well, I better go and see it. Sort of dragged myself into the cinema and texted my husband after about 20 minutes going, Do you know what? I'm actually quite enjoying this. I thought, I mean, he did sort of look bored, and then I didn't really. I think there were a couple of lines played for laughs that weren't really that funny. But the action sequence from the blow, I mean, they must have blown up about 300 vehicles in that opening 25 minutes. I was kind of awestruck by that. I think
the action sequence is amazing, but I felt it was way too early in the film for you to really invest.
That was almost the best bit.
Invest any emotion in why it was happening. Who are these people? What are they doing? I don't know anybody. So why are you giving me a 20-minute action sequence so soon? As impressive as it was. But I think basically what we can, you know, surmise from this is it's the Die Hard movie for people who don't really like Die Hard movies.
Okay. This is what we've got from it. Who's this from? This is from Paul McGarvey, a Scottish exile in Cardiff, winner of the Special Medal for Effort at the Southport Pontins Under-10s Disco Dancing Competition in 1986. I like this guy. A good day to Die Hard is aptly named, as mere minutes into it, I lost the will to live. Five Hard, is calling it, completely lacked any sense of jeopardy or the tension of a ticking clock that all the previous instalments had. Willis's signature character been reduced from a well-rounded everyman to a performance consisting entirely of hand dog expressions and feeble quips. The script could easily be filmed as the kind of straight-to-DVD quickie that Jean-Claude Van Damme or Dolph Lundgren should bash out these days. If we are to be inflicted with another sequel, I want the filmmakers, this is a good point, to think outside the box with the supernatural crossover Die Hard Sixth Sense, which would be apt, seeing as Willis is sadly now so reliant on past glories.
Harsh, but fair, I think. He has said he'll do another one. The movie's done pretty well. I think it's interesting that this one is a 12A certificate, whereas the previous one was a 15. Yet it's only made about the same amount of money. You'd think because it was available to more for more people to watch, being a lower certificate, it would put more bums on seats. It doesn't appear to have done that. So it hasn't flopped by any stretch of the imagination, but quite whether there's been enough money made for a sequel, I don't know.
Just in talking up to the news, we will have our interview with Gemma Arterton,
yes,
on the way, and also your review of Song for Marion and also Cloud Atlas, which is out this week. I've just got a minute up to the news. Who has replaced, you know, the action heroes of that era now, would you say?
The comic book heroes.
Right, OK.
Yeah, I mean, those are the biggest movies now, aren't they? Whether it's the Avengers or Spider-Man or Batman, you know, those guys are the action heroes. And actually, it's interesting that Bruce has this out now. Sly had a film out a couple of weeks ago, Arnie a couple of weeks before that, and they haven't done that well. I mean, people have a lot of fondness for their past, for their history, and say, oh, I used to love Terminator back in the day. They don't seem to want to see them do new films as much. The new films we want to see are the comic book ones.
Right, OK. Who are you looking forward to? I'm very much looking forward to Superman this year.
Superman looks good.
Is it Man of Steel?
Man of Steel. Iron Man 3 looks good as well.
All of those still to come. On the show, we will talk to Gemma Arterton, James's interview with Gemma Arterton, and all about her film Song for Marion and reviews of Cloud Atlas on the way. So much to squeeze in. We'll have to speak quite quickly, James, I think. Still to come, Dylan Moen Gray will be here to talk about his AIDS documentary, Fire in the Blood. Amazing story. You must listen up for that. But first, James, you have been talking to Gemma Arterton, whose new film is Song for Marion. We'll get your review after we hear the interview. Give us a sort of quick idea of what the film's about, James.
Well, she plays a choir teacher, a choir of OAPs, actually. Vanessa Redgrave is one of them, one of the singers. Vanessa Redgrave is married to Terence Stamp, who's a sort of curmudgeonly husband who doesn't really agree with what's going on in the choir. And there's laughter and there's tears and there's rapping and there's Gemma.
Oh, okay. Actually.
Keep an open mind when listening to this song. And yes, it is what they're talking about.
Spinderella cut it up one time.
It's got a nice little groove to it.
This is good.
Yeah, I like this.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
It is all about sex.
Why shouldn't we be talking about it?
Or singing about it?
Rather than just thinking about it.
That was a clip from Song for Marion, and I'm delighted to be joined by its star, Gemma Arterton. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's been a while, but I think Arterton fans can rest assured that we've got several good movies from you coming out over the next few months, haven't we?
That's right. I think there's four in the next, before May.
Yeah.
It sort of has happened like that in my career so far, where there's been like a big influx of my movies and then quiet for a couple of years and while I make them.
It's refreshingly uncynical, isn't it, Song for Marion? I mean, its heart is in the right place.
Yeah, it turned out that way, yeah. I think
was the script a horror thriller or something? And it turned out something completely different.
I think the original script was a bit more raw, actually, right. But then I think when you're reading it, just you in your room, whatever, you don't see the charm, you know, from the actors brought. So all of the choir were really, really funny and charming and sweet. And I think the movie ended up actually being much more more charming and it's about life and death and old age and losing people and grief, and yet it's uplifting. And I think it ended up that way.
So you play Elizabeth, isn't it, who's a choir master of a group of singing seniors.
Yeah.
And I've got to say to people listening, there is something amazing about seeing Vanessa Redgrave belt out Crazy by Niles Barkley.
Yeah, I know.
I never expected that in a million years.
And Let's Talk About Sex.
Yeah. Did she know about these songs already? I can't imagine it.
I don't know. I mean, there was something so gorgeous about her performance, because there's this sort of wide-eyed naivety to it. Which also is, the character is very sick, so there's this sort of fragility to her as well. And at some points I didn't know if she was acting or not, you know, which I guess is just genius, brilliant acting when you're not sure if they're acting.
And of course there's another legend in there as well, isn't there, Terence Stamp? Both he and Vanessa have this sort of sage-like quality about them, don't they? I mean, they are icons.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And it was, yeah, and Terence particularly, obviously, was such an icon of the 60s and swinging London, and had so many great anecdotes. I mean, I was just loving hearing his stories, and he was the real man about town. But also, it was just wonderful seeing these two people together acting, and they have their techniques and things, but together they were just phenomenal.
You have a musical background, don't you? I mean, music is a big thing for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You're in bands and things like that.
I was in bands, and there's lots of musicians in my family, and I'd say that it's my passion is music, and trained as a classical singer, and so I love it more than anything, music.
So would you do something on screen with music as well, do a musical film? I mean, it seems to be the big time for it, doesn't it? What with Les Mis and everything doing so well.
Yeah, I would do it. It'd have to be the right thing. I'm actually doing a musical next year on stage, a new musical. It's a big commitment for me and quite a nerve-wracking, because it's hard, 8 shows a week. So I'm having singing lessons and getting myself up to scratch. I think that's really when I'm having the most fun, is when music is involved.
And that's Made in Dagenham, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. The title may change, I'm not sure. Okay. But at the moment, it's called Made in Dagenham.
So people will have seen the film, it's that story, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's Song for Marion. If you want to go and be uplifted and you want to see Vanessa Redgrave sing Motorhead, it's all in there. If you want to see Gemma do the robot dance...
I know, I didn't even know I could do the robot dance.
Oh, but yeah. I don't believe
it. I kind of fudge it somehow.
Then after that, we then move completely 360 degrees and go to Hansel and Gretel, 180 degrees rather, and go to Hansel and Gretel, right? That's the next one out.
Yeah, funnily enough, I made that film just before Song for Marion, and Song for Marion was like the complete opposite. It was a deliberate choice. Hansel and Gretel is a big, violent horror comedy. And I play this very tough character. So the Song for Marion was, I wanted to play the softest, most cuddly character I could find. So, yeah, that comes out afterwards, ironically. And then after that, I have another one called Byzantium, which is about a 200-year-old whore mother vampire.
What kind of research can you do for that?
Well, lots of prostitute research, And I mean, a lot. And I had to go into, she's a lap dancer. And so I had to go and do a bit of lap dancing research. And but also, you know, she's this wonderfully maternal character. So I had to draw on a lot of my own experiences with my mother. And it's, I mean, it was a really great character.
Well, there's actually a lot going on there.
It was a great, great role for me. And I think it's a beautiful film.
This is the Neil Jordan movie, right?
Yes.
Who's already, you know, got previous experience of vampires and mystical movies with Interview with a Vampire and Company of Wolves and things like that. So if we're going to get more of that, then that sounds pretty impressive.
It's definitely a mixture of those two films. And for me, Company of Wolves is one of my, probably my one of my favourite films. And it definitely harkens back to that in visually and tonally. So, and it's a sort of feminist vampire movie, so it's one for the girls and the boys, but it's a new thing. I'm very proud of it.
It's interesting because when we said on Facebook that you were coming on, obviously people submit questions, and a lot of them were about that sort of variety and how you choose movies and how, I mean, it sounds as if the scripts you're getting sent now, if they're, you know, there's a lot of variety there and you're getting offered lots of different roles, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's true. I do definitely make it a conscious decision not to repeat myself. I think I'm now I feel much more like I know what I want, whereas before I didn't really, and I was just kind of going along with it for the ride. But now I'm definitely much more specific about choices and directors I want to work with, and the whole package rather than just the role or just the script.
Jonathan Hooper on Facebook references The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which is an amazing film. He said, obviously it's, you know, an uncomfortable film to watch. Did you need much persuasion to take on that role?
No, I absolutely leapt on that script. And a friend of mine who's really responsible for my career, Lucy Bevan, she's the casting director, she sent it to me and said, you have to do it. And I'd just done all these big glossy movies and was feeling a bit not very, very inspired. And this was, even though it was very hard to shoot, it was definitely more down the road of that. I enjoy that kind of process of where you feel a little bit out of your depth and a bit overwhelmed. And it was a gift.
And we've also got the Oscars as well fairly soon. I don't know if you have any, well, predictions or things that you would like to see do well in the Oscars.
I'd love for Haneke to get his award. I don't think he will, because it's quite the subject matter is strange. He's the best director in the world, in my opinion. And I loved that film. It's absolutely beautiful. But then on the flip side, you know, to go a bit more conventional, I loved Silver Linings Playbook. I thought that the performance, every element of that film worked and was gorgeous and brilliant. But I haven't seen every single one. I haven't seen all the performances that are nominated. But yeah, those are the two films that I really loved.
I've got a bit of a hunch about Amour. I just think something might happen with it.
Yeah, it'll definitely. Know. Yeah, I mean, it'd be great for Haneke to win Best Director, but he won't. And
be positive.
I
be
know,
optimistic.
But it's like Scorsese. He's never won Best Director, has he?
Well, it took a long. I think he has.
Oh,
but
it took
ages.
Yeah, it took
like
forever.
30 years for him to get.
And
it
was like, no, he shouldn't win it. Actually, as a sort of.
Statement.
A statement, yeah.
Gemma, it's been lovely speaking to you.
And you, thank you.
See you soon,
thank you.
Gemma Arterton there, chatting to our James about a song for Marion. James, before we go any further, people have been getting in touch with the show and have pointed out, shock horror.
That 360 degrees and 180 degrees are very different.
No, you've gotten away with that.
Away with it.
You've drawn attention to that now, which is great, because it might take the flak off me. I have apparently broken one of the Witter Entertainment rules of conduct by using my mobile phone to text my husband. Do I get granted a lighter sentence as it was during a Bruce? It was during A Good Day to Die Hard. I am normally very good. I won't do it again. I'll start.
I don't think it's my place.
Times.
It's not my place to judge. It's the people. You know, that's what these rules are all about. They're about the people.
I'm actually just going to take. They're going to take me out of the studio now. Something terrible's going to happen to me. I apologise for using my phone and breaking the rules of conduct. You see, someone should have given me this piece of paper before. I should know this. stuff, though, shouldn't I? And do you know the worst thing is I'm normally really good. I feel I've let myself down. I've let the whole school down.
You're digging now, aren't you?
I am. Let's move on. What did you think of Song for Marion?
It's like I said in the interview, it is a film whose heart is definitely in the right place. It's a film aiming to be uplifting and to be sweet. And certainly Terence Stamp is, I think, all of those things in the film, actually. A very tender, quiet performance from him. Really touching. And his final sort of big scene, which I won't tell you too much about, but is, I mean, you'd have to be pretty hard not to be moved by that in some way. But it was interesting that Gemma said in that interview the original script was something a bit more raw, because I think the raw and emotional pieces that remain in the film are the best bits. They are the bits that make you cry. They are the bits that really punch you in the stomach because they're tough to watch. It's the bits that perhaps have been added in a bit later, the wackier bits, the ones that I could live without, you know. So it's funny to see OAP's rapping once, but to see it several times, that joke wears a little bit thin. And I would have liked the film to have had more confidence in being serious and being emotional and being grown up and not having felt the need so much to just go for the easy jokes.
Yeah, I think it's after Exotic Marigold Hotel and Amour this year. I mean, both sort of, you know, very different films, but sort of dealing with older folks and their self-discovery and the tragedy of illness of, you know, your loved ones and stuff. It seemed perhaps a little bit lightweight. Can I say one of its strengths, though, I did think it was lovely that you really did have Vanessa Redgrave singing and Terence Stamp really sang there, unlike in sort of My Fair Lady, where you get someone else to do the singing. And that was, and their voices weren't perfect. And that was quite moving. I was really moved. I thought it was a shame to slightly underuse Christopher Eccleston. I wanted to know why, more about why dad doesn't get on with son. Just a few more things.
Let's have more
like
of that.
A little bit more.
And less of the grannies with their baseball caps on backwards, you know, pretending to be street.
But nice. And also Anne Reed, you know, she's amazing actress. I'd like to see more from her. Lovely to see the lady from Brushstrokes, who I've not seen on the screen.
I don't know who you're talking about, actually.
She was her mate. I think she was in Brushstrokes. Anyway.
Okay.
But some touching moments, though, I did shed a tear.
Christopher Eccleston is playing Terence Stamp's son.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, one's from London and one's from Manchester, but they work together so well. I mean,
really,
it's uncanny that they're not actual father and son.
And there are some really touching moments between the two of them. Both brilliant actors. Terence Stamp once sent me a postcard.
Wow, tell me more.
Perhaps in the podcast, I'll tell you that story, because it's a long story. It's a brilliant story. Everyone's like that. Yeah, right. So it's one of my seven stories. Okay, let's talk about the Oscars coming up on Sunday. Do you watch from the beginning to the end?
Oh, yes.
Yes?
Yeah, I think BBC World, I think I'm working for this year. So,
brilliant. Do you get to be there, or you're in a studio over here watching the results?
I mean, I think we've both been out there before, haven't we? But it is a bit of a bun fight when you're out there. And to be honest, if you don't have everything really set up to the nth degree and know that you've got the greatest place in the world on the red carpet, there's very little point in going out because you can get just as much, if not a lot more, from watching it on the telly. So that's mainly what I do, and that's what I'll be doing Sunday.
My trick that I do now is that I watch a bit of the red carpet and then I record it, and then I wake up before I watch any news and just watch the awards, so you can skip all that and you see all the gags and the funny bits.
That's the lightweight way
I used to do
it.
The whole thing with the bottle of Sancerre, but times have changed, James. Let's talk about who's going to win the Oscars this weekend. And I mean, where should we start?
Well, I think there are some no-brainers. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is where, come Monday morning, I realise I've talked a load of rubbish. But I think, you know, for example, like Daniel Day-Lewis, as I said earlier, has won pretty much everything in advance of the Oscars. So you would have to be a bit of a fool, I think, to say he's not going to get it.
Yeah.
Please don't play this back in a week's time when he hasn't won it. But, you know, I think it's going to be Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, surely.
And for Best Actor. And Best Supporting Actress, Anne Hathaway has been pretty much cleaning up all the award ceremonies for her performance. A great performance. Her bit, you know, when she sings I Dreamed a Dream, there's not a lot of her in the film, but just that moment, I Dreamed a Dream, 4 minutes, whatever it is, she deserves to win for that because it's
electrifying. And she cut her hair live and was traumatised by the whole experience.
There you go.
Surely that's
up there with Robert De Niro and Raging Bull, isn't it? Putting in all the weight.
It is. Actually, if you want to pass the time, something I did, I think it was last year, is I just sat and watched all the Oscars acceptance speeches from the 70s.
Yeah.
Brilliant. What an amazing decade. So there you go, pass the time. What do you think about actress then? Do you think,
I think
Emmanuel Riva will win for Amour?
Well, this is one of the slightly more open categories. If those two are sort of the absolute favourites, I think actress category is a little bit more open. because, you know, we have seen Jennifer Lawrence win some awards, we've seen Jessica Chastain win some awards, and actually they were the sort of two front runners up until the BAFTAs, and then Emmanuel Riva wins. So there's a third one now. So actually that category is fairly wide open. I mean, I suspect it's going to be Jennifer Lawrence, and all credit to her. I love that film. She's fantastic in it. But certainly when Emmanuel Riva picked up the BAFTA award for Best Actress, that threw a bit of a spanner in the works.
How much, I mean, I'd sort of out of interest, how much do the winners from other awards go on to affect people's decisions?
Well, I mean, there's some crossover in voters. Yeah. So you have to think that, you know, because if someone's a member of the British Academy, they could well be a member of the Academy in America as well. So they might be voting for the same.
But imagine if someone gave a really bad acceptance speech, say, well, they're just not a good sport. I'm not voting for them.
Yeah,
again.
I agree. I think, you know, people will from the industry will be watching. And if someone gives an amazing acceptance speech, it can only make voters warm to you even more. These things all do play a part. It's not just about how good you are. These things do, you know, play a part as well.
Let's talk and then quickly about Best Director and Best Film, the biggest awards of the night. What do you think will happen with Best Director? Do you think
tough,
it will Spielberg for Lincoln? Because obviously Ben Affleck didn't get a nomination.
Didn't get a nomination. Argo. And Argo, I'm pretty sure, will win Best Picture. Mm-hmm. I'd love to have seen him got a nomination, but I think actually it's made things a lot more interesting. If you want to be harsh, Ben might be annoyed, but for us viewers, it's made things a lot more open and interesting. The smart money would be on Spielberg for Lincoln. When that movie came out, that was the one everyone was saying, yeah, it's going to sweep the board. It's unlikely to do that now, but at the same time, I think he's still the front runner to pick up Best Director. But who else have we got? Ang Lee. You've got Ben Zeitlin from Beasts of the Southern Wild. You've got Michael Haneke for Amour. You've got David O. Russell for Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, a couple of those are unlikely, but it could be Haneke. I mean, that would be the director category. Sometimes people go, yeah, I might just vote for someone a bit more unusual, a bit more challenging. And certainly when Ben Affleck's not in there, that might just make voters just think a little bit outside of the box a bit more.
It's exciting.
I think it is. It's genuinely exciting. It's
also
very open.
Very excited about Seth MacFarlane hosting.
Yeah, I love Seth MacFarlane.
He's hilarious. And apparently Barbara Streisand is going to be singing.
Singing
that
Memories.
That excites me. She's singing Memories.
Well, this is why I heard. She'll be
really
singing Memories.
A worst song.
But over the In Memoriam piece, right. You know, which is always makes you blub anyway.
Right, okay. But that will be moving.
Yeah.
I was hoping she's singing Don't Say Rain on My Parade. Okay, that's the Oscars this weekend, and you can catch that wherever you can. Do my trick. It's brilliant, I swear. Record it, watch it before you watch the news in the morning. Okay, let's talk about Cloud Atlas, released this week. What did you think of it? I mean, it's epic.
It is epic, based on the best-selling book. And it has a lot of things going on in it. Epic is certainly the right word. Multiple stories. For example, there's one storyline set in the 70s, set in 70s San Francisco, about a journalist investigating a conspiracy within the energy industry. There's another story set in the 1930s Europe about a young musician who goes to work for an aging composer. There's another story set way, way, way in the future about a tribe surviving in a post-apocalyptic Earth. Six stories in total. The film drops in on each of them over this massive running time, 172 minutes, co-directed by Tom Tykwer, who made his name with Run Lola Run back in the day, and the Wachowskis, who made the Matrix movies. And the whole point of the thing is to say, look, these stories are all radically different, but ultimately we're all connected. Just because there are hundreds of years separating these characters doesn't mean that they're not linked. And lives don't actually just end with a full stop. They carry on resonating through time, affecting future generations. And one way that the directors use of conveying this is to use the same actors in the different stories. So it's a great cast list. Tom Hanks and Halle Berry and Jim Broadbent and Ben Whishaw and Hugh Grant, amongst others, Susan Sarandon. They play a variety of different parts. They crop up in all the different storylines. But apparently their directions were to play each character as if they had the same soul. So as if they were sort of a reincarnation of previous characters. Unfortunately, that all sounds quite amazing, doesn't it?
It does sound.
And the book, you know, I've read not all of the book, but I've read a lot of the book. And it is a great book. The movie doesn't really translate. And it's one of those situations. We were talking about Beautiful Creatures earlier, weren't we? Adapting books into movies. It doesn't work for a lot of the reason that great books don't translate, because you're just with a book like Cloud Atlas, which is a big book, for so long. So many pages, so many hours invested in reading it, so many weeks or months sometimes. And so you buy into it, you buy into the concept. And actually, ironically, even though the film is nearly 3 hours long and it's got a $100 million budget, it just doesn't seem enough to really carry off its ideas. It probably would have worked better as a miniseries or something, 6 1-hour episodes, something like that, you know, a 6-hour miniseries. But there's just no, it has to simplify things so much to pack it all in that you lose a lot of the impact. But there are good things. In a 3-hour movie, it's unlikely to all be awful. And certainly the actors in it seem to be having a whale of a time, don't they? I mean, I think they love it. I think they love the challenge of playing multiple characters. And even though Tom Hanks is one of the, you know, Hollywood legends, for him to dress up and put on prosthetics and sort of do panto stuff in a way.
Some which are good, some not so good.
Yeah, the Irish gangster, not so
terrible.
Good. But he looks like he's having a ball doing it. And I think that's important. Hugo Weaving as well, I'm a big fan of course, worked with the Wachowskis before in the Matrix films, really goes for it. And is such a great baddie in a lot of those stories. So the actors are having a great time, but the concept doesn't hang together. It's bizarre. It is a bizarre, strange film. The Wachowskis said, we want to make Moby Dick meets 2001. I think they've made Little Britain meets Blake 7. It's an odd combination that doesn't really work.
It's a strange one because for example, there were three of the stories that I quite enjoyed. The Robert Frobisher story with Ben Whishaw as the sort of young I can't even say that word, the assistant to the composer. I loved that story, and I really loved his relationship with his real love, who was played by James Darcy brilliantly. Yeah. Again, I loved that story. I would like to have seen more of it. I really did quite enjoy the Son Mai story. It's all about a fabricant.
It's
very
futuristic.
And Duna Bai, I think that's how you say her name, is an extraordinary actress. And Jim Sturgis is a revolutionary. Amazing visual effects. That was glorious. The Tom Hanks, I just thought he came off with the sticky end of the lollipop. The awful Zachary True of the Juju storyline it had elements of the Mighty Boosh about it. And if you've seen the Mighty Boosh, then it's very hard to take some of the characters seriously because they look almost as they're completely ripped off.
It's interesting you said that. Same reason I said Little Britain. Also, League of Gentlemen as well. The idea of people dressing up in these weird outfits and funny masks. And it's quite difficult for the moods to, which swings around so much from farce to really serious stuff to futuristic stuff. It's difficult to stay on board a story like that that is so all over the place.
I know, it is all over the place. But there are, like you say, some great performances in it. And I think worth seeing for the good bits.
Yeah, because it's odd. Yeah. I mean, it's a misfire. In the States, it hasn't really done very well. But it's worth seeing just because it's so crazy.
Peter Knowles from Timperley in Cheshire. I can never say Timperley without saying Radio Timperley. He says that I was fortunate enough to get preview tickets, went with my wife. Having read the book, I thought I pretty much knew what to expect, namely multiple, often confusing storylines connected by common themes and ideas. Unfortunately, I felt the film suffered from the same faults as the book, being both overambitious and tonally lumpy. On the plus side, acting was solid throughout, particularly Ben Whishaw and Halle Berry, although Tom Hanks seemed at times to be channeling both Dick Van Dyke and Professor Goldthwait Higginson-Dore from the Lady Killers remake. And he says the farce of the Timothy Cavendish section, which is with Jim Broadbent, felt completely out of place. The neo-soul of 2144 was perfectly rendered. That's the bit I liked. The biggest gripe, he said, was the unintelligible sub-Clockwork Orange dialogue of the bit you were talking about with Tom Hanks. But he does say that he counted 4 walkouts in the first half hour and he actually left before the end. But his wife, who had not read the book, she was unable to finish the book, she absolutely loved it. And there's quite a few people who have really enjoyed it, like Megan Day in California. She said, aside from the rather dodgy and maybe what could be misconstrued as seriously dodgy makeup, I utterly loved it. I thought every actor played each of their parts fantastically, especially Ben Whishaw, James Darcy and Jim Broadbent. I couldn't get the whole thing out of my mind. Epic is the only word I can think of to describe it.
I think there's something so eccentric about it that it is quite beguiling.
Yeah.
That's the best thing I can say about it. I certainly wasn't bored because it's so crazy. You just don't know what the hell's going to happen next.
I have been trying also to cry with tears just from the bottom of my eyes. Which, do you know, did they do that with makeup? Was that clever or is that
know.
Just... No. you have to see it to know what I'm talking about. Right, we will be speaking to Dylan Moen Gray about his incredible documentary, Fire in the Blood. That is all on the way. But right now on Five Live, it's time for the news. Thank you very much. You're joining Zoe Ball and James King with Movie Review this afternoon on Five Live. And we're delighted to be joined by Dylan Moen Gray, trained historian who worked in close collaboration on many films with Peter Greenaway and Paul Greengrass. He started his own film company in 2005. And Fire in the Blood is his first feature film as director, writer, no doubt best boy, key grip, camera operator and tea lady as well. It really is a brilliant documentary. Welcome, Dylan. Fresh in from Dublin.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, tell us, how did you come across this story? And tell us a bit about what this incredible story the documentary tells.
Well, the film tells a story of what I consider to be one of the great crimes in human history, which is how in a minimum of 10 million people were left to die of AIDS when there was affordable and available medication which could have treated them. And essentially that was because of pressure that was brought to bear by Western governments working on behalf of multinational pharmaceutical companies. And I originally kind of stumbled upon this story when I was working on a film in Sri Lanka back in 2004. And like a lot of documentaries, it began with an article I happened to read in the newspaper. And that article, you know, was talking about one of the characters in the film, who's Dr. Yusuf Hamid, who lives in Bombay. And by a quirk of fate, the friend that I was there with happened to be related to him. So, you know, I just started talking about the article, and she's like, you know, are you interested in meeting him? Because when you come to Bombay, you can meet him. So that's what happened. I met Dr. Hamid, and through him, I met a couple of the other main characters in the film. And, you know, it was very clear to me that it was a very important story to tell. Also because there was a really inspirational cast of people that came together to break this blockade, which I think is actually really what the film is about. You know, initially I didn't think it was going to be me that would do it. I tried to actually enlist a couple of friends of mine because I don't come from the documentary side, but everybody saw it was going to be a huge project, which it turned out to be. So literally I had a feature film that I was supposed to do, and you know, I literally woke up one morning and I said, I can't do it. I have to do this other one. Because the story was being lost and I just felt it was too important to let go. So I cheesed a bunch of people off by jumping ship on that other movie. But I thought it would take a year and a half or 2 years. It's been 5.5 years. But nonetheless, I do feel it's really the most important work I'll probably do in my life. So I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to do the film.
It's really, it's a real life David and Goliath story, isn't it? I mean, I was, you know, appalled first at the situation could happen in sort of, you know, in the modern world. But also the fact that it really is people who persevered and took on the big guns to get this kind of change and get those drugs into Africa, where so many people were dying. One of whom you speak of, Dr. Yusuf Hamid, incredible doctor who in India eventually sort of said, okay, come on, we'll make the drugs and sell them for cost in Africa. And then all the people who came up again, and it's a chap called Jamie Love. I mean, tell me a bit about some of the characters in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I couldn't have said it better myself. To be honest, you know, I was just so inspired by, you know, these people who, you know, in most cases were not well-known people, didn't have a big community or a lot of resources behind them. In fact, they were laughed at, ridiculed, you know, told that they were raising false hopes. You know, very, very few people believed that AIDS treatment in Africa was possible, even in the medical community, even in the African medical community. You know, so, it, you know, there were really just a handful of people who thought this was even, you know, feasible. And you know, you mentioned Jamie Love. He's one of the characters in our film. He's a very interesting guy for me, really symbolic of this group, because he's somebody that had nothing to do with health, nothing to do with AIDS, nothing to do with all of these issues. But, you know, he had a knowledge of intellectual property, and he just couldn't understand why nobody could tell him what it would cost to get these drugs to Africa if there were no patent barriers. Mm-hmm. And all the people that should have been able to answer that question could not. And unlike 99.99% of all of us, he just didn't stop until he got an answer. And, you know, and he really changed the world. So, you know, people like that for me are incredibly inspirational, not just because of the specific story, but it just shows that any of us could actually really make a huge difference if, you know, we just set our mind to it. And, you know, so literally even after spending sort of 5 years watching him, you know, I continue to be inspired by that.
I mean, it's quite an incredible story as well, because basically, James, you've seen it as well, haven't you, that the people in Africa who did have money, for example, is it Justice Edwin Cameron? He had the money, I think it was a third of his wages as a judge, to pay for the drugs. And within a couple of weeks, he was fine living this incredible life. And yet the pharmaceutical companies would not drop their patent. I mean, this is something that people might not sort of understand. Can you explain a bit more about the patent situation and why these drugs couldn't get into Africa?
So, you know, what many people don't realize, especially in a country like the UK, where, you know, a lot of the costs are not directly borne by the consumer. In developing countries, people pay out of their pocket for medicine almost exclusively. So, you know, they're very price sensitive, and patented drugs, you know, are essentially priced for the Western market. Pharmaceutical companies are really only interested in the very richest sliver of the world's population. They're not really interested in the rest, which would be fine, except they have a monopoly. So, you know, in the case of these AIDS drugs, you know, the prevailing patent laws in almost all the African countries basically forbade lower-cost generic drugs from coming in. And, you know, it's easy to vilify the pharmaceutical companies, but real for me, the real villains of this piece are the Western governments that mm-hmm. did their bidding, you know, and, you know, just untold millions of people died horrible deaths who easily could have been saved. You know, and I think it's an incredible scandal.
Over 10 million people, they think, could have been saved if the drugs had been available.
10 million, I would say, is a conservative estimate.
Shocking, isn't it? Quite unacceptable. Yeah. We have a clip. We have a clip of the film. Have a listen.
They have us as their hostages. If we face an emergency here in Africa, we shall die because the laws don't protect us.
Lack of access to medicine increasingly affects people in Western countries as well. Almost half of all Americans now say that they are unable to afford their prescription drugs, a number which grows with each passing year.
In the US, to stay healthy and well and not die is not a basic human right. And that's why we have the system we do have here.
The companies can't continue to take the position, they're just Africans, let them die. And it's going to be even harder for them to take the position, they're just old Americans, let them die.
Clip there from Fire in the Blood. James.
What I like best about it is that it's not a documentary that needs gimmicks, is it? It's not there to be clever. It just simply, and in a very focused way, lets the stories do the talking. Now, I'm sure that actually achieving that when you've got hundreds of hours of footage is easier to be said than done. However, I think it really achieves it and is incredibly poignant because of it. What was the editing process like? Was it just this mammoth task?
It was, actually. And, you know, people often ask what was the hardest thing doing the film. That was definitely the hardest thing. You know, and actually, like you said, I'm quite pleased and gratified when I hear people say, you know, the construction is fairly simple because it took a lot of work to achieve that. And it was very difficult. You know, there were a lot of things that, you know, that were very hard to leave out. And but, you know, I realized a lot of the information in the film is quite new for most people. So, you know, you didn't want to overwhelm them with information. You wanted to make sure that people could come out of the film feeling, you know, emboldened, strengthened, and able to take the information they got in the film and actually communicate it and take it forward. So, you know, that process of paring it down over the course of a couple of years was indeed quite complex. But I think we finally managed to do a good job at it.
There are some incredible facts that come through. And I think the way you reveal these facts rather than sort of bombarding people with information is really good, because you're right. I knew nothing, really very little about this story. And you had the time to take it in, because there's a lot of shocking facts in this story. And some wonderful characters. And you have an incredible cast list in there. You have Bill Clinton in there as well. Yes. Was it easy to get him to come and talk to you?
Not really, no. But, you know, nothing's easy that's worth doing, I guess. And, you know, it took about a year and a half. And but finally, you know, just shoot through sheer perseverance, I guess, and just finding a couple of people in his organization who just liked what we were doing. You know, they finally granted the interview, and it was quite an adventure, actually. There's a funny story associated with that, which I'll tell very briefly. But you know, it took us a long time, and there were a lot of people in his organization who I don't think really wanted to give us the interview. And a lot of people actually have told me they feel I'm quite easy on President Clinton in the film, but that's another story. But anyway, so I had just had knee surgery, and I had to go to Hong Kong for this interview and hire a crew. And, you know, it really wasn't great setup. But, you know, I realized I was only going to get one chance. So they'd scheduled the interview, and then his schedule was quite tight during the day, and they kind of bumped us unceremoniously, and it looked like it was just going to not happen. And so I was sort of hobbling around this huge complex trying to find somebody from this press department to, you know, take pity on me, because it seemed like they were just sort of had cut us off. And I'd met somebody early in the morning who was the one kind of friendly person from his team. And she said, "Oh, you know, you're a really bad boy. You know that, Dylan?" And I said, "Okay." And she's like, "You didn't tell me you're with Ron's people." And I was, like, you know, I'm holding no cards here. So I was like, well, you know, can't really go into that. I had no idea what she was talking about. Anyway, it turns out there was this rumor circulating that for some unknown and inexplicable reason, that we, instead of being an Indian documentary crew, were actually an undercover team from Ron Howard's production company. And suddenly all the people who completely had dissed us moments earlier were treating us like royalty. And in fact, you know, literally half an hour later, I had Bill Clinton sitting across from me and, you know, completely snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. And I was hoping to meet Ron Howard at Sundance, and I didn't get a chance to, but I still owe him a huge debt of gratitude. I have no idea why.
That's incredible. That is brilliant. And I mean, they're incredible facts. Like, I was amazed at the tiny percentage of the huge profits that are made by pharmaceutical companies actually go back into medical research. There's so many awesome things like that. We probably won't have time to cover all of that. But if people want to see the film, Dylan, how would they go about that?
Well, we're starting our theatrical run tonight at the Prince Charles Cinema in London, and then on Monday we're showing it all over the United Kingdom. So I hope people come out and see the film, because I'm sure they'll be happy they did. Plus, you know, virtually all of our screenings have panel discussions afterwards with some really amazing people. So, you know, I think it'll be a memorable evening out.
It's one of those films that you really do want to discuss quite heavily afterwards as well.
Yeah,
so that's a great idea. Yeah. There's also a website, www.fireintheblood.com. It's an amazing documentary and a story that really needed to be told. So well done, Dylan. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, time for some travel. What are we going to talk about next, James?
Mama is a horror film, executive produced by Guillermo del Toro, about two young sisters who have to survive out in the woods in the middle of nowhere by themselves for 5 years. Now, we don't exactly know how they did survive, but we know that after the 5 years, they are discovered, they're rescued, and they mumble things about someone called Mama, who looked after them during their time out in the wilderness. And the girl's uncle and aunt, played by Nicolai Coster-Waldau, who you know from Game of Thrones,
Jamie
right?
Lannister from Game of Thrones, and Headhunters, of course, yes.
And Jessica Chastain, who plays the aunt. They take them in, and they move them into a big new house. But Mama, whoever and whatever she is, doesn't seem to have gone away. Here's a clip.
Hey, girls.
Hey. Come here.
Mama.
No, don't call me that. I'm not your mom. I'm Annabelle. You can call me that. Or Annie, or whatever you'd like. We could work it out together, right?
It's got me already.
I mean, a lot of it is horror by numbers.
Yeah.
And actually, just in the last couple of years, you might have seen things like Sinister and Insidious and The Awakening, which have similar things going on. The usual things, you know, people moving to a new house with a dark, mysterious past. And I always like odd kids doing weird crayon drawings.
You know, I quite like a sort of nursery rhymes.
Nursery rhymes.
With a swing, hearing a rusty swing.
Mysterious scurrying footsteps at night. All those things are in there. So it's familiar territory. However, that's not to say that going through the motions isn't entertaining, because Jessica Chastain is great in this. All gothed up. She's got black wig, black eyeliner, tattoos. Complete chameleon actress, really. Doesn't look anything like how we've seen her in other films. And much of the film is about her transformation from being this cold-hearted auntie figure to being a loving mother figure to these two girls that she has to bring up. So it's not just about the horror stuff. It's also about her personality as well. And generally, the whole film does have that Guillermo del Toro polish to it, so that even if the story is a bit generic, the styling and the visuals will be very strong and haunting and eerie. So I think it's a solid little horror movie, actually. Familiar, maybe, but well-paced, well-acted, well-designed. And crucially, of course, this is the most important thing, it's scary.
It's scary.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a short film. It's based on the same director as the feature film, made a short film, which Guillermo del Toro saw and loved. And that's how the feature film got produced. And that's online. So if you want to see the short version, which is only like 2 or 3 minutes.
It won't ruin the twist. Online.
No, not at all. It's very, very, very basic stuff, but eerie.
Okay. See, I'm terrified. But you listed Insidious and I wouldn't see any of those films, because then I'm just useless with horror. I can't do it. I have to watch it with the sound down.
It is one of those genres that really, you know, it's...
You love or hate,
you can praise a horror film up to the hilt, but ultimately if someone doesn't like horror films, they're never going to go and see
it. Also, it's that
they?
Whole thing with when you're a mother and you have kids, the whole children being in trouble. Oh, I can't do it. To the Wonder, Terrence Malick.
Yes. His last film, do you remember this? His last film, which was The Tree of Life with Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain and a lot of dinosaurs, was actually, do you remember, it was quite controversial because some people went to see it and within like the first 20 minutes walked out and demanded their money back because they're outraged by his slow pace and his abstract style. And it's fair to say that this isn't a man who follows the traditional narrative paths. But, you know, he's sort of a mysterious figure. He disappeared for like 20 years, didn't make any movies. And to the wonder, it stars Ben Affleck, Olga Kurylenko, a couple of who have a holiday romance in France before heading back to the States to live there. And it's about the ups and downs of their relationship, the challenges. Javier Bardem and Rachel McAdams also appear as two of those challenges to the relationship. But if you're looking for traditional romantic fare, this isn't the place. Actually, at the preview screening I went to, I was given press notes, which is what journalists are given. Yeah. And I was reading them after the movie. And you find out things about Ben Affleck's character, how he wanted to be a writer and how there was meant to be a five-year gap between the French scenes and the American scenes, and about the factory that he and Olga live in is supposedly got pollution from a factory. And I was just sat there thinking...
But that's not in the film.
I didn't know any of this from the film. This is great. This sounds amazing. But none of that comes across in the film. I'm all for enigmatic, but, you know, having to read a press release afterwards to work out what the hell is going on just seems a bit like inconsiderate storytelling. So whilst it is beautiful to look at, you've got these endless shots of Olga Kurylenko dancing around in cornfields, waffling in French. What is this love that loves us? You know, it's all very pretty and beautiful. You can have too many of those. Fewer shots of cornfields, a little bit more information
about the characters
wouldn't have gone amiss.
Okay.
So you're left with a film that undoubtedly has, you know, intellectual rigour behind it. And I'm sure Terrence Malick, in his head, it's all perfectly clear. But he hasn't really conveyed that to us, the audience. We just sit there. Actually, I sat there thinking... A lot of this looks a bit like, you know, at Christmas you get lots of perfume ads.
Yes.
And perfume ads these days are just incomprehensible. They're just ridiculously arty-farty.
Yeah. It actually, women in leather on motorbikes.
It feels like that's
shutters
Keira
going
Knightley.
Open
yeah.
and close.
Yeah. It actually feels, when she's dancing around her cornfield speaking French, it feels like a perfume ad. I don't want that.
When Brad Pitt's going to pop up.
Terrence yeah. Malick's amazing. Badlands is an amazing film. I don't want to feel like
Days
this
of
about
Heaven.
One of his films.
Incredible film.
But yeah. unfortunately now... That is what I'm feeling. So I'm glad he's making movies again. And actually, you know, look at the Oscar list, The Master and Beasts of the Southern Wild. All these films clearly owe a debt to the style that Terrence Malick has. Incredibly influential filmmaker. But there is nothing dirty about explaining the plot. That's, you know, Terrence, you can do that and still be great. That's not a bad thing. And the themes of the films about how people change, about how passions change and how you have to make decisions is really interesting. But unfortunately, Olga Kurylenko dancing around in cornfields isn't enough to really explore that.
Okay. We have sort of, you know, 2 minutes left. Yeah. What would you like to talk about? Is there a movie on telly you want to talk about? Is there another film that you could review in... A minute and a half, James.
Well, we could mention the Breath of the Gods, couldn't we?
Oh, good. Yes, yeah. The yoga film.
Which is a documentary.
Yes,
yeah. And
it is.
I think we're both in this same situation because I think we both do a bit of yoga. So we both heard that there
do
was a documentary. Yeah, yeah.
Could have done a couple of salutations while the news was on.
I cannot tear myself away from a downward-facing dog. I really can't. I mean, I just love them. Anyway, the thing is that this is quite intense. And I suppose the whole thing about yoga is that it's, you know, meant to be very chilled and relaxed and it's all about poise and being gentle. And so the film's pacing really matches that. And that can be quite trying after yeah. several minutes of watching it. I actually saw there's another yoga film I saw a while ago called Yoga Inc., Yoga Incorporated, which is sort of a much more punchy, full of pizzazz version of the history of yoga. This one is very, very dry and very poised. And very sensible and a little bit boring. So even though we might both go and do a few tree poses every now and then, it's really, I mean, even for us who do yoga, it was tough. If you've never done yoga in your life, you're going to be bored out of your mind.
I can't imagine anyone who's never done yoga would watch this film. There's some great historic footage of people doing yoga and some incredible poses and stuff like
Hard
that.
Work,
but
though.
If you love yoga, you might enjoy it. It's quite good. There's some nice Rachmaninoff and Rimsky-Korsakov music
in
it. Now, this has been a Something Else production for BBC Radio 5 Live with James King. James, your film of the week
It's Mama,
is...
the Jessica Chastain horror movie.
Fantastic, which you've really liked a lot. Next week, Mark and Simon are going to be back with Richard Gere.
Wow.
No less. I know. And I don't think they've had him on the show before. And they're both very, very excited about it. James, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Really enjoyed this afternoon. Thanks for all your correspondence. If you want more, check out the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. So that was the show. I think apart from a couple of mistakes, it was all right in the end.
It's, you know, that's what everyone was expecting, and we give them to them, you know.
I know, they need a little bit of that. What did you say?
Yeah. I got my degrees mixed up. Degrees. I was never good at maths, that's why I don't need to be. That's
why
fine.
You review films. Exactly, and I've apologised now on air for using a mobile phone. I've let myself down. We didn't get a chance to talk about another film that we both saw this week, Laura.
Laura tells the story of a young German girl and her family right at the end of the Second World War, and her parents get captured by the Allies because her dad is a Nazi officer. So she has to take her younger sister and her brothers to their grand's house right in the north of the country. And obviously the country at this point is in an absolutely terrible state. I mean, completely anarchic state. And it's about their journey through Germany, through this land that's in chaos, discovering a lot of harsh truths, really, in the wake of Hitler's death. All of it seen through the eyes of Laura, seen through the eyes of a child. And I think as soon as you give a serious event like this a fresh pair of eyes, not the eyes of a grown-up or a politician or a soldier, we've seen those movies already, but through the eyes of a young girl, you do get a very different take on a piece of history, a different angle, and you think you know everything about it, but then you see some new things. There are still original things to say. I suppose the closest thing we've had in the past, the boy in the striped pyjamas, mm-hmm. Which was a heartbreaking film about a concentration camp seen through the eyes of a young child. This is more of a road movie. It's a bit more meandering, has echoes of that. But Kate Shortland is the director, actually, Australian director. This is an Australian-German co-production. Her last movie was called Somersault with Abbie Cornish, which was also a teenage girl movie, a coming-of-age movie. And there are sort of echoes of that in this, style-wise quite similar, very beautiful, but very heartbreaking at the same time. It was Australia's official Oscar entry into the best foreign language category because it is in German, and it didn't make it into the shortlist, which is sad because actually it's really good.
What is in the shortlist? What's up for best?
You can put
just
me on the spot. I've got it on my Oscar.com in front of me. So in the best foreign language category, we have, if you hold on a second, please, caller.
I would see Rust and Bone was one of my favourites. Amour.
Oh, you've got it there, have you?
No, I'm making this up. This is. I don't think. Are they? Amour is on the list, I'm pretty sure.
I can't find it on this list. Oh, here we go. Yeah, Amour. Mm-hmm. War Witch from Canada, A Royal Affair from Denmark, No from Chile, which is out now, that's good, and Kon-Tiki from Norway. You would have thought it would be Amour. I mean, that's certainly one that's grabbing the headlines, isn't it?
Okay. You can't sort of say you enjoyed this film because it's sort of tackling, you know, such kind of horrible atrocities. But it's interesting to suddenly think actually about the families of those who, you know, caused these awful atrocities, left behind, and how they went on to deal with their life. And also all the propaganda and finding out what, you know, the truth about what their parents did, for example.
I mean, it's not apologetic about it at all, but I think you have to realise that these were, you know, human beings. The kids in the family, it's not their fault what their parents were doing. And it's interesting to see how they coped.
I know. It's a stunning piece. I've sort of felt aching of tummy afterwards watching it. I think, again, you know, as the mum seeing these children go through that and all the teenage rumblings, and there's some really beautiful moments in it. And it's called, Laurie, and it's L-O-R-E, in case you're looking for it, because it's spelt in the German way. Which leaves us time for your television movie of the week, James.
The Runaways is on 9 o'clock. On Saturday the 23rd on Film 4. It's about the band of the same name, the garage rock band formed in mid-70s California. Pretty groundbreaking, actually, in their day for being feisty, focused women in the rock industry. Joan Jett, of course, is the most famous. She went on to find solo fame. She played by Christian Stewart in the film. Got that kind of sexy snarl about her. She's good in this, actually. But I think best of all is Dakota Fanning. She plays the other mainstay of the band, Sherry Curry. The wild blonde bombshell really goes for it. And the best thing about the film, apart from those performances, actually, is that it captures the craziness and the wildness and the hedonism of being young and in a band and having some money for the first time and going on tour and just having the time of your life. It really gets that.
I've never seen it.
It's fun.
Forward to seeing
it's a lot
brilliant.
Of fun.
Oh, do you know what? It's been lovely to see you.
You too.
Thanks very much, Five Live, for having us. Let's not leave it so long next time, James King.
See you later.
He's never going to ring me, is he? Next week, Mark and Simon are back with Richard Gere. Oh, talk about timing. Thank you.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.